Hey, Radio Statler fans, this is Johnny Christmas on the air with one of my absolute favorite tech writers, Zach Whitaker.
Hi, good evening. How are everyone?
Of ZDNet. Go ahead and get right up on that mic.
Hi. Ooh, yeah, hello.
Don't be afraid of it.
I'm a little bit. Just a smidge. Are you okay?
I made these drinks a bit strong. We're enjoying a couple of glasses of some warm rum and Coke here. It's some of the best warm rum and Coke I've ever had.
So what is this? Is this rum? This is rum. This is Coke. What is this?
Oh, no. This is the rum and Coke.
Rum and Coke.
This
okay,
is pre-mixed.
I'm not drinking anything that's not alcoholic besides this straight bottle of vodka that I'm drinking.
Right. That doesn't count as alcohol.
That doesn't count. No, that's all.
No, if it's straight, if it's clear, it's good for you. And then we have in the other glass, this is Malort, Jepson's Malort, a wormwood liqueur from and only in Chicago.
That's your native hometown, isn't it?
Yes, that's the land of my people.
I've been.
Yeah.
It's a great place. I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it a lot. My partner and I went a couple of years ago, and we walked past an NSA building several times without even realizing it until we saw The Intercept reporting a few weeks ago.
Oh.
When right there, this windowless building is the NSA telecom switch station.
Yep.
For, yeah.
Oh, what did we used to call that place? It had a different name back in the day. Not Paradigm.
Back in the day?
Yeah, I believe they moved to a new building now. Never mind. They used to be in an old... Oh, there was a word for the project. It's like Paradigm, Faction. I can't think of it now.
How many years did you spend at the NSA?
Right. Well, it was one of those things that
he
came out...
He says not commenting.
Moving on.
Wait, who's interviewing who here?
Yeah, stop it. This is
I'm sorry.
Because now I'm trying
to default.
Google up with the name of the... Anyway.
theintercept.com/secret-NSA-buildings-org-johnny-xman
/janitor. It's actually a Google building there now. Google's taken it over, and the NSA's moved.
So what's different?
So where you were is the current NSA building.
Right.
Yeah. We love our surveillance in Chicago, let me tell you.
You know, not too far from where I live in New York City, there's a building, the AT&T building, on... I think 10th Avenue. And it's this tall, windowless building that looks miserable from outside, but also like daunting and terrifying. And there's always been a police presence there. And I've long believed that was kind of a building that was, you know, suspect. It was something to do with the intelligence community.
You just get that vibe from it.
Yeah, there was an absolute vibe. And there's a building downtown. There were two buildings in New York City, and doing various different things. And it's kind of... The Intercept did a fantastic bit of reporting on that from the Snowden archives, and it was fantastic to kind of discover some of the secret buildings in your city. I love learning about... Look, aside from all my InfoSec stuff, I love learning about, you know, hidden stuff in cities. I love learning about the underground. I love learning about the things that you never see, the things that you never, you know are there, and discovering those.
Yeah.
A few years ago, there was a piece of the Berlin Wall in... It's something like 60th Street and... maybe 5th, there was a piece of the Berlin Wall in New York City, and you could see it, and you could walk up to it, you could touch it, and it was the most beautiful thing. And I don't believe it's there anymore, but it was quite wonderful.
It was outdoors?
It was outdoors.
Interesting.
It was I can't remember, it was called Paley Park, Paley Place, something like that, but it was actually not too far from Trump Tower, as I recall, but it was, it's quite something to see.
That's interesting that you could actually touch it.
Yeah, it was right there, just there. Wow. This beautiful painted wall.
We have a piece of it in Milwaukee.
Yeah, of all places.
There's an amazing spy museum up there that's also a restaurant and bar. And
that's a bizarre.
Oh, it's awesome. It's you have to know the password to get in, or else they
really
they interrogate you to make
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6! !
Are you?
Password.
Are you a router?
Don't take the piss out of my accent. So. No, you can't. How many? Did you know prior to this meeting? Did you have any inkling that I was English?
No, not at all.
So was it a bit of a surprise for you?
It was.
Was it?
Yeah, and I talked to a lot of Australians a lot as well, and so now I have this issue where I have to take a moment to discern: is this Australian or British?
No. Why would you? Jesus Christ.
Yeah. No, I realize that's offensive.
That is.
Like, I'm very aware.
Are you Australian? Are you from New Zealand? Are you South African? Are you British? Yeah, I've had a fair few things.
If it helps, I was leaning heavily towards British. And you know what gave it away was the rooter when he said that.
When I said rooter, it's like, oh, there we go. He's a foreigner.
Yeah.
Although
yeah.
this past week, I did get my green card, which was a huge...
Ooh. Congrats. Yeah.
Thank you very much. So, I'm now a permanent resident. I'm a proud immigrant.
Until Trump declares you can't be here anymore, regardless.
Basically. So, I mean, at this point, we're talking, it's 9:08 now. I'm expecting something anytime soon. We'll see.
I have a friend from Australia who was set up to move here in about 4 weeks. And we had extended Australians a special long-term visa for helping us in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And he was taking advantage of that and was moving here indefinitely. And Trump's recent dealings with all immigrants and, you know, rejecting all the extended visas and such like that rendered him unable to visit here. And he was, you know, purchasing a home and everything. Yeah. And just out of nowhere, one day, nope, you're no longer welcome here.
Yeah. It's revolting. Look, I know in this day and age, it's almost uncouth to talk about politics because politics is so fractious and politics is so difficult to talk about, and I know everyone's divided, but at the same time, you know, it's kind of the one thing that brings us all together, and the fact that we all want a better place, and denying people right to this country who bring good things, who bring good value, good work, is horrifying. It's upsetting.
It absolutely is, and it's not as if
it's not American.
My friend who was trying to move here was trying to He wasn't coming here to mooch off of the system like everyone says they do. Yeah. You know, he wasn't coming here to collect welfare. And yeah. I'm not sure who does that anyway. Like, oh, let's try an entirely different country, and let's hope I can mooch off the welfare system
the
there.
The people who come to this country in dire straits and dire needs don't come here because they're looking for a better life. They're escaping death and murder.
Yeah.
Anything is a better life than that.
Be it murder or even just starvation.
Right, and they deserve to be here. They deserve to be in this place because this is a good place for good people.
We have...
This got political quickly, didn't it?
It sure did. We have not sure if it's a rule or a law down in Florida. It must be a law because of the way that it works. But any Cuban refugees which make it to the shore are allowed to stay.
Good. If you have traveled on a raft, on a lifeboat, on any kind, if you have managed to make it the straits, I think it's something like 20 or 30 miles, maybe it's longer.
It's 90.
90 miles. Okay, well, yeah. 90, if you manage to make it 90 miles on any kind of material that gets you to the into the mainland, you deserve to stay. Yeah, sold.
And that was logic. Like, if you touch the sand, you're in.
Yeah, as it should
get
be.
Get a job. Let's do it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's not like we're running out of space in the U.S. I mean, half the U.S. is just like, is desert anyway.
Not desert, but yeah, uninhabited.
Nothing's there.
Nearly all of the U.S. is uninhabited.
I could take most of Montana and just like plant my flag down like that. Plant my flag and be like, this is mine. And not many people... A few people would protest.
Eventually, someone would find you.
As a single person, I would outnumber most of them, of the people who live there.
Yeah.
There's no one there.
And as a white man, you would outrank the natives
As a British man, this is what we do. We go into foreign places, we plant our flags with our guns. Do you know much about Eddie's art?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Cake or death? Cake or death?
Cake or death?
Cake, please.
And I've death. Got the answer. I'm in cake!
Yeah. You said death first. This is like 11 minutes in, and we have taken a ride.
Yes, we've gotten imperialism, racism, politics. This is great. This is fantastic. I love this.
This is the news hour with Johnny at Christmas.
This is my goal. I like to bring in the particularly notable guests who come here to Hope and bring them in and talk about things that aren't the same things that they're up on stage. Or even, in your case, writing articles about...
I was going to say, in my case, who are you bringing in this hour?
Eddie Snowden himself.
Yeah.
Coming to hang out. Yeah, so sorry about that. I just like organic conversations. And I think that's more beneficial to the listener than me coming in with my, you know, going through a sterile list of questions that I spent hours figuring out and pre-programming. I wasn't... They're emergency questions.
Emergency questions
questions in case it was necessary. I guess we should do a little bit, actually, of an intro for you for the listeners who aren't aware of your work.
I mean, we're 12 minutes in. I mean, no one's... Who is this British guy? Who's this guy? This random guy who's, like, talking...
I thought we got rid of all the foreigners.
I know.
How'd he get in?
Actually, funnily enough, through a very difficult immigration process that... funny story, I went to the immigration office for my interview, which I wasn't meant to have because Trump changed the rules. Thanks, Trump. And I went to the office, to the reception area, and the woman who works at the immigration services said, I love your accent.
Mm-hmm.
But you work at the immigration services. I'm sure you've heard many... You must have heard my accent before. And it was so lovely to hear. But it was almost this brief moment of naivety where it's like, she's like, I love your accent. It's like, thank you. I love yours. It's why I want to stay in this country. Can I have my green card?
I don't think anyone has ever said they love the American accent.
Never underestimate the power of the Southern accent. The Southern accent is beautiful. We love the Southern accent.
I will accept that our Southern accent is our version of the British accent. It's abroad.
Brilliant. You know, I don't really have the accent per se, in that I didn't grow up in London. I didn't have that kind of... I pronounce...
Are you actually from Atlanta?
I'm not. Yeah. Busted.
You got me. It's all a ruse.
I grew up in... and this kind of sounds a bit crazy when I'm saying it out loud. I grew up in Sherwood Forest, in the village where Robin Hood allegedly got married and had his band of merry men.
So this is a village that people still live in.
Yeah.
It's assumedly a normal modern society there now.
Terrible OPSEC. Now everyone knows I grew up somewhere. I grew up in a small village in North Nottinghamshire on the South Yorkshire border, and we have a very bizarre accent. A very bizarre northern accent. It's like kind of your southern accent compared to the rest of the United States.
Sure.
Accent.
Can you give us an example?
No.
Okay.
It's hard to... I've been here for 6 years.
Yeah.
It's hard to kind of go back.
You have to get into the mindset.
I do. And the
practice.
Only way I could do that is by getting my mother on the phone and calling her and having a conversation with her. But at this point, it's now 2 o'clock in the morning and she's probably still awake drinking at this point. To be honest, it's England. There's not really much else going on there.
I feel like you all have a lot going on there at the moment, though.
We're a bit busy trying to...
Every time we say Trump here, you say Brexit.
Exactly. Like it's a real fucking mess, and we're not having a great time of it, to be quite honest.
But now you get to wash your hands of the whole thing.
Well, you say that, but my passport in the next 10 months, I'm going to have to tear it up. I'm going to have to get a new one.
Yeah.
Because I'm not...
You no longer have EU access.
Which really sucks.
Yeah. And I understand we're being peered at.
Is it because I swore?
But
is it because I said a swear word?
Cheshire Catalyst.
Are you from the FCC?
Yeah.
Are you going to arrest me?
I think he's the one man here who's the furthest from the FCC.
Are you Agent Pi? I've got some words that I want to share with you, son.
I've invented some new ones.
Yeah, just for you. You want to kill some net neutrality? Come through me first. It doesn't sound that threatening with a British accent.
No, it doesn't. It's well, it sounds like you
come
can
at me, governor.
It I'll sounds like you can do it with money when you say like, you want to kill net neutrality.
I love you, you bugger. Yeah, I'm not really that threatening.
This is great.
Time for some emergency questions.
Yeah, emergency. Dead air.
So
I asked for like an intro for yourself, and you literally started at Sherwood Forest when you were born.
I was
wasn't
born
looking
once,
to go that far back.
And then I got tired ever since, and I became a journalist. And
did,
I became more
did that
tired.
Help?
It didn't help.
It sounds, I wouldn't have chosen.
It's not
I
the
decided
best
to be a writer.
I struggled through that.
What made you move here?
It was a bit of a bizarre situation. This was back in 2011, and my boss and I were discussing kind of how my career could progress, and the whole idea was come to the United States. You know, I'd spent many weeks and months cumulatively in New York prior to that. It was actually kind of bizarre because I kind of came to America for the first time not really liking Americans very much, and that sounds like a really crazy thing to say, but we had this bizarre perception of Americans in the United Kingdom at the time, and it was a post-war kind of perception that Americans weren't really kind of had the finger on the button in the foreign affairs space and so on. And we were...
What year would this be?
This was maybe even back in 2009, 2010. You know, we kind of, you know, we'd been through years of war. We were exhausted. We kind of been dragged into something.
Yeah, so post-war, really, like post the most recent war.
Post-recent war,
although
which is...
we've been in nine
point,
of them, right.
Exactly. Nine in this last, like, 10 minutes, yes, at this point. And so I came to this country... be very skeptical of kind of America and what it was, and I quickly realized in this borderline strange kind of like perception of America that, you know, Americans were, you know, I had this perception of Americans. I came to America, I quickly became to love Americans. I loved New York. I remember the first time I got off the shuttle bus from JFK to New York City. It was pissing down with rain, and it was warm and humid and gross, and I was in Times Square, which for anyone, any New Yorker, Times Square is just the worst place to be.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely
garbage
because there are no New Yorkers there.
They're just Elmos, giant Elmos and Cookie Monsters.
It's just a flood of
and
Elmos.
Woody from
three
Toy
blocks
Story chasing you down for a tip,
and Statue of Liberty impersonators.
And I, yeah, and I settled down, and I fell head over heels in love with the city so quickly. Any kind of like negative perceptions, any kind of thoughts, any kind of skepticisms just shot away in a heartbeat. And I love New York. I've always loved New York. The people are great. And I came here and I just needed, I know, I at one point I came here for work, you know, maybe once every 6 weeks, and I needed to be here. It was almost like a relief. It was almost like a home away from home. I fell in love with the city. I really fell in love with so head over heels in love with the city. And I decided I wanted to move here. I wanted to do something big here. I wanted to do something interesting, something new. And I ended up coming to New York one time in 2011. And I was like, I want to make this my home. I put in a transfer request, and my boss and I agreed that, you know, I could do some work here for 6 months.
Where's ZDNet based out of? Or is this
ZDNet
a different boss?
ZDNet's very global, more global than most people think. So my name is Zach Whittaker. I am a reporter for ZDNet. That's a good start.
Now let's get the show rolling.
Yeah. So I'm the security editor, which is an honorific at best, to make me feel better about the situation.
I'm a security article generator.
You are. No, you are.
Yeah.
So I ended up coming to New York for 6 months. I got a visa for 5 years, but I was here for 6 months. And then the Snowden documents dropped. And it was late in the evening on June 5th, and we scrambled to try and understand what was going on with the metadata 215.
Hundreds of pages.
Oh my goodness! It was
and everyone needs to be the first outlet to get information on this out.
And the Guardian published their story, and they were, we all know that there were Greenwalds. Glenn Greenwald was based in Hong Kong at the time, writing the story. On his laptop, in the hotel room, Snowden, in the same room, and that ended up being, I stuck around for another 6 months, and then I stayed a bit longer because there's more work to do. And I stayed for 4.5 years before my visa was running out, and I was like, I have to stay.
And now you got your green card.
I do. One of the stories that most people forget about, and it's one of those stories where you talk about it and it sounds unreal. What happened was maybe around 6 months into the Snowden leaks, into the cache of documents that leaked, the British authorities stormed into the Guardian's offices in London in King's Cross, and they took hacksaws and angle grinders to computers that they thought the Snowden documents were on.
And just based on their immediate assessment of the physical devices? They said, oh, it looks like that one. These three, probably.
It was part of a bizarre public relations stunt between Downing Street and The Guardian, and they allowed the authorities to come in and destroy computers that they thought the documents were on. They were wrong. But at that point...
Of course they were.
Of course they were wrong, because the documents were already in New York City. And it's worth pointing out that...
Hold on. So instead of removing the servers and...
They destroyed them.
In-house, they showed up with hacksaws and angle grinders and went to work.
Yeah, and The Guardian filmed them doing it.
That's insane.
And it was on the front page of The Guardian the next day, and most people forget about that. And so my point is that...
I don't even recall seeing that.
Right. I can pull up the page right now on my phone.
I'm doubting
it. No, but my point is that most people forgot about that, and it was maybe, I think it was January, 6 months later, that I realized, I made a calculated judgment that I can't do my job for the United Kingdom anymore, my home. We've never had freedom of the press. We've never had freedom of speech per se, in that, you know, you can say God forbid you say a racial slur, you can be arrested for that in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, I think that's...
It's a public order offence.
That's definitely something I think a lot of people in the States here don't realise. You know, we...
You have a constitutional right here to freedom of speech.
Yeah, and we know of London, we know of, you know, the UK, and we share a common language, and so of course we...
Just about.
Have familiarity.
Yeah.
We share a language we've thoroughly bastardised. Intentionally.
He said it, not me.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's... Let me tell you about Webster. And we think that it's very much the same over there, except you have a bit more of a posh accent.
Yeah, we have a queen, you have a president. And you know what? The fact of the matter is that I realized very quickly at that point that I could not do some of my reporting back home for fear that, you know, we have... You know, in the United States, the only job that's ever mentioned in the Constitution is the press.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the only job that's mentioned in the Constitution, and it's maybe the president.
Militia. Hey, we can split hairs on that, but
just about.
Yeah,
you get the idea.
Yeah,
I mean, but the press is really kind of the one thing that binds this country together, is mm-hmm. the free press, and I can't do that from the United Kingdom anymore.
No, you can't.
And it's sad.
I mean, it's an absolute police state over there, too, even with just surveillance. Like, you're famous for the level of surveillance that goes on.
There is, but, you know, there are places in the world that are taking that to the next level. There are places like China, which is using that surveillance state model that the UK has and expanding it in such a way that, you know, it oppresses, you know, the Muslim minority, you know,
mm-hmm.
in the country, and it's horrific.
I'm a regular visitor to China, and I've been to the Muslim quarter.
Yeah,
delicious food. But you really see it. You really see how they are all cordoned off in this small section, pushed way off into the corner of the country, and it's seconds away from an internment camp.
Yeah,
over there. Is. And the surveillance, and they're not sneaky with the surveillance. They have these trees of cameras all right out in the open.
But the problem with overt surveillance is that with any surveillance of any kind, really, but overt surveillance is that it prevents you from speaking your mind. It prevents you from... It inhibits you from talking about the things that you need to do. The benefit of public speech and being able to have freedom of speech is also the benefit of private speech, is being able to privately think about your thoughts, you know, in private, and discussing these things with yourself, and not having these things surveilled in a way that, you know, can, you know, if so eventually you can come out with a public statement that's refined and
sure.
perfected, you know.
Absolutely.
And having private speech is almost as important as public speech and freedom of speech.
Absolutely. That I feel like that's critical. I can't, if you ask anyone to sit down and imagine a world where everything that they did and uttered aloud was documented for effectively anyone to retrieve, there's no person alive who wouldn't be absolutely terrified by that thought. And yet we live in a world where some of the most populated countries on this planet do effectively that to the best of their ability.
It's kind of fascinating from a technical point of view, the amount of data.
Absolutely
fascinating.
Every time I see those trees of cameras, I think, wow, where must all this go? And then I talk to some people about that, and they said, well, 60% of those cameras don't even work.
Some of them have been spray painted by graffiti artists. Some of them have been pissed on by a drunk guy in the street, and they're not working anymore. It happens a lot.
Yeah. In China, maybe not so much. They're pretty strict over there.
Yeah, I've heard.
But there's a lot of show. I mean, I was in Beijing recently for the second or third time, and they have a tendency to assign a security detail to foreigners who come in, who, especially if you're traveling in a small group and just wandering around, you'll notice you'll be eating supper with the same people a lot.
Is that two to tables over you, or is that protect them?
It's both, and it's an interesting conversation to have, because it's very philosophical. It's what half of it is to make sure I'm not up to any sketchy business, that I am in fact just wandering around and seeing the sights. There, I mean, I had taken, I had driven down to a local mining, or it was a not a mining town, a dock town, a place where, you know, it was a small shipping town, and I was just wandering around, and tourists don't go there. And it was odd to see me there. And I had seen the same two gentlemen at various restaurants and various stores we were in. They always kept a distance. And by the third time, I was like, oh, it's those same guys. Maybe they're, you know, tourists too. And they were walking around in the stores, looking at things, talking to each other.
Narrator voice, but they weren't tourists.
Exactly.
They weren't tourists at all.
So we're walking around the street at some point, and they approach us. And they say, hey. And in English, say, hey, how are you doing today? I said, good, thank you. And do you mind if we talk to you a little bit? No, not at all. And they let you know that they're just working. They work for China, and that's what they'll say. Oh, we work for China, and we just found it out that we were here, and wondering if you needed any help or if you were lost. If maybe you were trying to get somewhere else and ended up here, is there something we can do to help you? Yeah. And it wasn't a we generally are trying to help you, and is there anything China can do for you to help you get back to where you're supposed to go? It was more of, you are lost. You should probably be somewhere else. What can we all do together to make sure that you are where we would rather you were at? And it's that sort of thing. So that happens a lot. And also, if you do get intentionally into trouble, they'll approach you relatively fast, and they... when they pull you aside, or they approach you, and this, if God forbid you end up in a police station, it's they're very direct about it, and they say, you know, you're doing some things that we don't like here. You can knock it off, or you can go home, or you can stay here in a way that you won't like. We would rather you knocked it off. But at the same time, if you get into trouble, if you say something at a bar and you get into a fight over a misunderstanding, they'll come out of the woodwork and they'll break it up and they'll get you back to where you need to go. They very much do. They don't want you going back to your home country and saying, you know, China's a terrible place and I got my ass kicked in a bar for simply saying that I disagree with their views on Taiwan. Now, if you come in and say this whole place is shit and your food sucks and you start getting your ass kicked, they'll let that happen for a little while. It's sort of like a hockey match. Well, the referees will, they'll let it go until they think that you've gotten enough, and then they'll come in and break it up, and then they'll pick you up, and then they'll say, where do we need you to get you back to where you're going to be safe?
The same kind of thing happens in England, except it's not the state that's doing it. It's the people in the pubs who are ordinary citizens who will beat the crap out of you. If we think, you want to say something about our food? You want to criticize our queen?
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll kick your ass.
But then... will the bobbies come and no.
They'll watch for... No, actually, the police in England have always been very good, but, you know, the one thing they lack that, on the most part, that American police have are guns.
Yeah.
They don't really have guns.
Famously.
Yeah. They have sticks,
mm-hmm.
and they will beat you with them in a nice way.
Sure. In a very polite British...
And they'll
British.
Apologize while they do it.
bordering on Canadian...
borderline Canadian kind of like happiness and
very sorry mate, but you drove me to it.
Yeah. sorry
about
I'm
that.
Really sorry that I'm hitting you.
That's
very
sting.
Hard with this stick.
Put some ice on that when you get home.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not too far.
I'll tell your mum.
Yeah.
Now here they just shoot you.
Yeah.
Especially the darker you are. Oh, man.
This got dark quickly, didn't it? Yeah. Goodness me.
Well, what do you want?
No,
that's what happens here.
It's what happens here, and it's deeply upsetting.
We're no longer at a point where we can say, well, oh, it only happens in certain cities, and no, it's a very tiny... It happens everywhere. Yeah. I mean, I'm from Chicago, you know, you're in New York.
I mean, I'm from England, but yeah, I'm basically in New York.
Yeah.
The funny thing is, I've been a New Yorker for... I think I was born a New Yorker. I just didn't realize it until about 2011. I kid you not. I love this city so much.
It's funny. I say that about Iceland and Reykjavik.
Iceland is meant to be beautiful. I'd love to go.
I just went for my fifth time a few weeks ago.
No, I saw your... I'm sorry. I've been religiously keeping an eye on your Instagram because the... If anyone,
well, you're a journalist. That's your job.
That's my job to keep an eye.
That's
but
Johnny, finger on the pulse.
Johnny Christmas has this wonderful Instagram where he keeps an eye on the sights and delights of Iceland.
I try to I have.
How long were you there for?
A charmed life. I was there for 10 days.
Ten days. You had 6 weeks of Instagram content. For 10 days. Are you kidding me? You were there for 10 days.
Well, I was gone for 10 days. Two
it
of those were travel.
It felt like you were there for a month and a half.
No, it felt like that to me too. And I'm still sad that I had to leave. That wasn't enough.
You can go back anytime you want.
I'm already planning on going back this year. I was hunting for cabins while I was up there.
Do you need to have a car? Okay, this is not really helpful for anyone.
Let's talk about Iceland. Go. No, it is because everyone wants to go to Iceland. I hear this all the time.
It's 5 hours from here-ish, give or take.
Yes.
It's 6 to the UK, so I could just jump on a plane and, you know, on my way. Do you need a car to go around Iceland?
If you're staying in Reykjavik, no. Right. In fact, absolutely not. It's terrible.
Okay.
The public transportation is great, and once you're in downtown Reykjavik, you just walk everywhere. It's a city of 76,000 people. It's not that big.
Yeah, it's tiny. I mean, the entire island is 300,000.
Yeah, you could bicycle around the whole city in a morning. It's don't worry about it. You don't need a car. However, if you want to leave Reykjavik and go see the gorgeous parts of the country that are out in the wilderness, yeah, you need a car, and you can rent one easily. It's right side drive, so
yeah,
nothing
I can't
strange.
Drive. I should really drive. I should learn to drive.
You don't
know
how to drive at all.
I know how to drive. I'm just not allowed to drive.
Okay, well, I'm in the same boat then.
Are you?
Yeah.
You're not allowed to drive because you're a terrible driver.
Yes. No, I'm still allowed to drive. I should not be, and I have had that. I have had that privilege revoked a number of times. If you go ahead and look into my records, you'll see it's mostly traffic violations. And
well, now I know what I'm doing this weekend.
You know what? Get back to me.
I put it on
Instagram.
I unfortunately am unable to drive for a medical condition that I have that is deeply frustrating, but my doctor doesn't think it's a wise idea for me to drive. Should
really?
I kill someone?
I can. Do you want to talk about it?
We can. More than welcome to.
I was looking for a segue to bring it up.
Well, what would you like to talk about more? Would you like to talk about the bizarre medical condition that I have, or infosec journalism, or both?
Well, I was going to lead from the first into the latter. And
oh,
so,
interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know how, but I was going to try.
Going to.
I was hoping that would...
Let's try it. Let's go
so,
for it.
So, Zach Whitaker, as I understand it, my sources tell me that you've been suffering from Tourette's. I assume it's been a lifelong condition?
Almost. Since I was 12.
Okay.
Or 11. Yeah, so I have this bizarre condition. Many people know about Tourette's, and they see it as the stereotypical condition where you twitch, you shout, swear, you...
I think you mean they know of Tourette's, however they're not familiar with...
Right, and so it's a relatively common condition in the sense that, you know, millions of people have it, you know, around the US, and... which I suppose, given your population, is quite a drop in the bucket, really. But it is a bizarre condition where people swear, people shout, people twitch, people mutter, people grunt, people make noises, mm-hmm. and people flail. And
I think many of us have come across someone with Tourette's and didn't realize that that was what was going on, and we may have called it schizophrenia or something.
Well, surprise, motherfucker. I have it.
Oh!
And I'm proud of it. I'm actually weirdly proud of it. It's difficult. This is my first con. Mm-hmm. That I've been to.
Really?
Yeah. And
Hope was my first con.
Oh, fantastic.
Almost 20 years ago. 18 years ago. H2K.
How old are you?
Don't
answer that.
I'm probably older than you.
probably.
Do you see the grey in my beard again?
Well, I mean, you don't see the grey in mine because half of it's ginger. But this is my first con, and I think it's kind of interesting to bring up in the sense that, you know, I suffer with the social anxiety of having this condition. It's a very public condition, and mm-hmm. I've tweeted about it before. Because it's important that people know about it. People understand kind of the, you know, they see something weird on the subway and they don't really think too much about it. They just see it's a weird guy doing a weird thing.
Yeah, you and everyone else.
Right, and, you know, there's a genuine illness behind it, a genuine condition behind it. And so many people have social anxiety. So many people have, you know, issues, you know, whether it's a mental health issue or otherwise. And people need to be more empathic
about it. Or just general social anxiety.
Yeah, exactly.
I think maybe that term's overused now when it's just, you know, fear of public speaking or something.
But that's okay because, you know, I have this fear of being around people, being around cons. And, you know, I have this fear that I'm going to be around and I'm going to twitch or shout or say something or, you know, and it's going to upset someone or concern someone. It's going to make someone feel uncomfortable. And I'm just a guy, you know, I'm nothing special. I want to be around, you know, people who I feel comfortable around. That is hackers, security researchers, you know, people around here, you know, I feel safe with, I feel comfortable around. I feel comfortable around you and other people around here.
I was just going to ask, how are you doing here so far?
I'm doing great. You know, and you know what, you know, I know people, I've matched names to avatars to Twitter profiles and so on, and it's great, it's a lot of fun. And, you know, I wish people were a bit more open-minded about, and not to say that people are not open-minded, but I wish people generally were a bit more open-minded to other people's differences. I think that's really what makes it matter. You know, ultimately we are a community. I know I'm a reporter, and I know I'm kind of like, I'm not hacking into things, I'm reporting stuff, but I love security. And I love trying to figure it out. I love talking to people who are like you and other hackers and other researchers. It's important to me. You know, it means a lot to me.
I would say that you're hacking into general society with your reporting on the hacker and the security scene. It's one of the reasons you're one of my favorite reporters, is because the way that you present the information, you have this knack for. Not only is it something that I can send to my father and say, hey, take a look at this article, and he's definitely going to get what's going on there and why it's important. But at the same time, it's something I myself, as someone who is buried in the information security and just general, you know, computer security community, can still read and also find interesting. Whereas if I look at I was actually just reading a local news story the other day, and I won't call out the reporter, but just, it was clear they didn't understand what they were even reporting on. They improperly defined some technologies involved in there. They improperly explained why it was even important or how it works. And it's like, I can't believe this. How is this allowed to go on? And this person probably makes more than you because he's a huge local Chicago news personality. But then here you are, like, just laying it out. And actually, here, I have my laptop in here because you had called me out. I was looking at a bunch of your articles in your feed.
Why is he looking at my stories? What did I do wrong? My immediate thought. What did I say?
Yeah, I was like, let me quick. Time. He's here in 10 minutes. I gotta find the bullshit. So in like 2012, you wrote this article where you stated, "Do you recall?" No. And what really got me as I was just scrolling through here was the headlines themselves. And I don't know. Do you actually write those headlines?
I do. Yeah.
Okay. These are excellent because,
to be fair, the headlines are usually proposed by me, and I run them through a few people.
Mm-hmm.
It depends on the deadline. It depends on whether it needs to be out here and there.
For sure.
Sometimes I will write a headline myself. Most of these headlines I write myself. I will always get feedback. I think that's the key point, is I always get feedback on everything that I do.
Okay. And that's why I ask, because I understand sometimes the author never gets to write the headlines.
And that's annoying. That sucks because the reporter cares so much about the story, and they don't often get the time or the opportunity to write their own headlines, and they get dumbed down, they get bastardized in some way, and the headline does not reflect the content that they're trying to go. And every word in a headline matters. You want them to bring people in, but you want the headline to be fair. You do not want it to be clickbait. You want it to be honest.
Yeah.
You want people, they want it to reflect the story.
Absolutely. And I think that's what you really accomplish here, because they're clickbait to me, in that there's no bullshit in here. It gets right to the point. It tells you what's going on in this article. It conveys a sense of urgency for things that require urgency and why it's important. And that makes me click on it because I go, this sounds like something legitimate that's not going to be a waste of my time, and I should click on this and read it. And what's funny is I will often see the headline, I will click on it, I'll start reading through the article, and I'll go, who wrote this? And then I'll look, and oh, it's Zach again. Yeah. And that happens a lot.
I think the trick is for a reporter is to know your audience. I mean, there are stories where, you know, I wrote this thing about Venmo this morning. The story was essentially, you know, Venmo transactions are public. They're completely public.
You know, let me interrupt you there. This is a hot button for me.
It is.
So trigger warning. Days ago, I was writing something to communicate with the Venmo back end to be able to dump all those things. And then I was going to start doing statistical analysis on all of the words that were used and then just report on that. Because just for fun, I thought it'd be funny.
Yeah.
Days later, I don't know what happened. Days later, things like that hit the news.
On the
rug got pulled out from under me.
On July, there was a story that came. There was a researcher who sent an email to several reporters last week about his analysis of the Venmo transaction. Mm-hmm. They're all public now. Look. If you have an app,
they've always been public,
and they've always been public,
and everyone's known this. All of the users are aware.
They are aware that the data is public. But here's kind of how I see things: in that, if you have an app where or like Facebook or a service where your data is public, you realize that your data is public and exposed to a degree. But you expect them, based on the content of your timeline, your Venmo timeline, or Facebook timeline, for mm-hmm. example. That even though the data is there and it's available to anyone, you expect it that maybe there's an over expectation that the data is confined within the walls of that service, like Venmo, a timeline, or a Facebook timeline. You don't expect it to be published on a broadcastable API where anyone can scrape it. And maybe that's my naivety, but I think maybe that's where people mistake that public means public.
To contradict your naivety there and say that I believe that. That's most like a naivety on the part of security professionals and security researchers, in that we think that everyone is aware of what public means and the extent to which public means. Whereas you're saying that, well, Venmo users that know that this data is available to other Venmo users, they don't realize it's available to Johnny Christmas, who's not a Venmo user.
There's a granularity, I say, when it comes to certain things. You know, public can mean many things, to be quite honest.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why, and I had a conversation with a friend of mine today about the basic constructs of on the record, on backgrounds, and off the record. None of which are basic constructs, frankly, because they're not. On the record means it's easy, you know, everything is good to go.
Mm-hmm.
On background can often mean, you know, it's okay to use, just not attributable to me. Off the record is this weird gray area where people, and this is really important to know because so many people don't realize this, that it changes and it can be completely misinterpreted. To me, when someone says off the record, you can't use it in any capacity, in any way, shape, and form.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas some people say, oh, it's kind of like on background. You can't use your name. You can use it in certain circumstances, certain times, in certain places. Well, no. And actually, Steve Reagan, who works for CSO online,
Steve Reagan's a good friend of mine. Another excellent reporter.
At Steve D3 on mm-hmm. Twitter. Great guy. He wrote this story, this kind of report on GitHub maybe a couple of weeks ago. And it was a great breakdown of what these things mean. And the problem is that public can mean anything if you really want it to. It can be completely public, exposed, you know, broadcast on the ticker tapes on Times Square,
mm-hmm.
or it can mean within the app. Whereas the basic constructs of kind of how people talk to reporters can be misinterpreted and changed and modified, you know, person by person. And this is a real problem that I find that a lot of people have with reporters. And, you know, look, frankly, reporters have a bad rap a lot of the time. And I feel like reporters...
I think that comes from there being a lot of bad reporters.
I think that comes from having bad reports. I think that comes from having bad ethics, bad morals. And I think it's really important that reporters don't just necessarily explain kind of how they do things, how they go around things. I think reporters need to be more transparent than ever. whenever I report on a data breach, I explain how I came to the conclusion that I did.
Mm-hmm.
I explain that I did password resets. I enumerated information. You know, I went through Mellanator accounts. I don't break this, you know, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. You know, you've got to stay within the law. You've got to stay within your bounds. You've got to stay within your means. You've got to be transparent and open about these things. And you have to be the same with reporting as a whole. You have to be transparent and open. Journalism is not proprietary. It's not a secret. You should be able to explain to your source and say, look, this is kind of what I want to use, and this is what I believe you don't want me to use. And you have to explain the rules. And the more people who know about journalism, I feel, will be better equipped to battle things like fake news, battle things like misinformation, battle things like bad reporting. And bad reporting and fake news are not the same thing.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
And I think it's really important that people know more than ever. And this kind of works both for hackers and reporters, in that, you know, everyone kind of, you know, a lot of people rather assume that hackers are bad people in balaclavas on a keyboard, you know, on their arm, you know, typing away, or multiple keyboards, you know, all that ridiculous stock imagery bullshit. I think people think hackers have a bad rap because of the portrayal that they have.
Yeah.
Reporters the same way. It's about being transparent and open, and I feel more and more that hackers and security researchers are more open about what they do than ever in this day and age, in the last like 5 or 10 years especially, because they want people to know that they do good work, they do good moral ethical work, mm-hmm. within the guidelines, within the rules, within the laws. And reporters are so closed off about kind of how they do things and how they approach subjects and people that it makes it impossible to trust them.
Is that because as a reporter you have to build and maintain a personal brand, and deviating from that brand waters it down?
There is, to some extent. I mean, if I was to write, you know, 50 security stories and then maybe 5 non-security stories, you know, I would argue that my kind of brand gets kind of watered down in a sense. But it's not really about... I mean, I've always had this kind of perception about my kind of position in journalism. I've never believed for one second that I kind of work for my company, in a sense. I mean, I do. I do work for my company. Mm-hmm. You know, I give them information and I get paid for it. It's great, you know. But I work for people like you. I work for hackers. I work for security. I am a someone who wants to represent you in the best possible way. I want to represent your work. I want to show your work. I want to display your work to the world. And I work for people like you. And it's as simple as that. I am accountable to the community that provides me information in good faith. And I report on it. And it matters. And there are very few reporters, I feel, in the world, in any kind of topic, in any kind of area, who aren't militant about it. There are people who are like, in my opinion, Steve Reagan, who is a fantastic reporter. You know, Lorenzo Motherboard is a great reporter. Joseph Cox is a great reporter. Dan Gooden is a great reporter. They've, all these people who are great... Lily Newman at Wired is a great reporter.
Yep, yep.
I can just keep listing names.
Well, but at the same time, you can, of the number of reporters out there, it's a short list.
There aren't many people. And I feel like in security, there's either, in reporting InfoSec and national security, which is very much a kind of like, it's like a Venn diagram where two circles kind of intersect, mm-hmm. intersect. And I feel that there are very few reporters who really kind of understand the whole breadth of the security community. And there is a short list. I feel that many companies out there, many news organizations are focused on the money, on the clicks, on the advertising. And they're focused on trying to get squeeze as much out of news reporting as they can. Whereas on the other side, you get the reporters who really are, like me, and like Steve, and like Lily, and like, you know, and Lorenzo and Joseph, who really are just want, you know, we kind of want to be hackers, but we're not, and we're reporters instead. We're trying to represent you in the best way that we can. And we care about it. We're geeks. We're nerds.
Yeah.
We love it.
And it's blatant. It's extremely obvious.
I think you can see where the line is, and there are
and you're still getting those clicks, you know. It's surprising. Doing good work still gets the traffic that's expected, you know?
I think for us, it's kind of, it's, you know, as reporters, you know, we try and we want to represent the people who we believe that we're accountable to in the best possible way. And we really care about this stuff. We care about all kinds of things, you know, whether it's, you know, encryption at rest and transit, you know, data breaches. We care about all these things, and we're trying to show the world the work that you guys do, the things that you find, in a way that's fair and honest and represents you in the best possible way. And there are so many reporters out there who, and I don't necessarily believe it's their fault, but they are constrained by circumstances that they're in.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure, you know, depending on the organization you work for, there are powers that be above you that are...
And that's difficult. For me, I'm very lucky in that my editor-in-chief gives me a great latitude to do the work that I need to do. My boss is fantastic. He's always given me the scope to do what I need to do, things that I need to report. I go away for sometimes for months at a time, and I work on stories that are in depth. You know, the story that I did recently on the faulty breathalyzer, which was one of the longest stories that I spent.
I remember that one.
That story took a long time to work on, and in the meantime, I was still writing stories here and there. If I don't write, I get cranky. I get so cranky. I need to be doing something all the time. I mean, you can be working a big project and do side things, and you know,
sure.
And that's kind of how I deal with
it. I mean, that's a sign of what you should be doing,
right? And so for me, you know, I spent a long time on that, and he gave him the ability to write that story. He gave me a lot of, you know, time and effort on that, and that's having that freedom is rare. And I think security reports of all kinds of reporters need to take the time to think about what they're doing, about what they're saying, about what they're working on. Security is one of those topics that you can't get wrong. You just can't get it wrong. If you get it wrong once, it knocks you down and you have to build your way back up. It takes one hit to the reputation and you can lose trust. You can't get things wrong.
Absolutely see that, yeah.
Because if you get one thing wrong and you have a scoop, and you get one thing wrong and it gets propagated out there, it spreads like wildfire.
And then for years, wasn't he the guy that said this wrong thing 3 years ago? Forget that. Forget him.
Yeah, you have to be really careful with this stuff. And I pore over this stuff. You know, I would rather miss a deadline or an embargo time, or I'd rather completely just like screw a story's timing up completely if it were to get something right. This week I had a story which would have been a really great story that I had to drop in the end, because it was one of those I just couldn't get the backup that I needed to really build the story out. And it was frustrating, and I won't describe the story, but it was frustrating that I spent time and energy on, and other people who were involved in the story spent, you know, the researchers who spent time give me answers, and I ended up having to drop the story. And unfortunately, it sucks. Yeah. And it's tough.
I mean, you put all their time into it.
Yeah, and they did too. But it was one of those times where the story just did not work out, and I would much rather have a short, sharp shock than to have a story go out that's wrong or incorrect or that has misinformation in. You really have to get things right, you know. And there are some reporters out there who have got an excellent track record. Some really, really great reporters have a great track record, and you should read them and you should savor them while we have them around, because they're just great at what they do.
I recall when the Shadow Brokers leak happened, Andy Greenberg had hit me up, and another great reporter.
He's a fantastic reporter.
Yeah, and he had asked me, I was ranting on Twitter, as I do, about various things, and making some statements and some judgment calls, and he had DM'd me and said, hey, what's your thoughts on this? Can we talk for a while? And I gave him a good long several-page write-up on my interpretation of what was going on, and I didn't see an article get published on it, and like a few weeks had gone by, and the story was starting to die down, and I was like, what happened with this? And so I actually, instead of hitting up Andy, like, I was suspicious, like, is this guy just like not going to credit me? Did it get published somewhere and I didn't see it happen? So I hit up Steve Reagan, who's a friend of mine, and Steve Reagan is amazing because he is very deeply rooted in the hacker community. He shows up to the conferences. He knows everybody. He's on the board for Circle CityCon.
He's one of my favorite reporters.
Oh, he's the best.
And he, I should, Yeah, I'll say this. He wrote a recommendation for my green card, and he was one of the reasons why I got my green card was because of him.
I'm going to tell him about this.
He is one of the truly one of the kindest people I've ever come across in my life.
He is. He tells all of us, and this is why I ended up contacting him. He tells all of us, if you ever need help, if you find yourself in the middle of a press firestorm, if the media is hounding you because of something you did and you don't know how to handle it and you're not sure who to trust and who not trust, please contact me. Yeah. And we'll work through it together and I'll help you out. And he did, and he's helped me out. He helped me out the TSA keys thing.
Yeah.
And so I went to him when I thought Andy was trying to try something wacky with me, and he said, you know, sometimes the story just gets dropped. Sometimes he can't put together the article he's looking for, and it turned out that was the case.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, that's cool.
It's tough and frustrating. It's tough for the researcher. It's tough for the hacker. It's tough for the reporter. It's tough. You know, I think the last time we really spoke was that story that we wrote, that I wrote on the lawsuits. Do you remember this? This is the way back when. There was a story that I wrote, and I think I mentioned, you know, to you about the story that I worked on about the lawsuits in InfoSec.
Oh, yeah.
That was one of the proudest stories that I wrote in a long time. I was so proud of that work because so many people trusted me to tell their story, and some people told me on background, so I wasn't able to use their names, and mm-hmm. I respected that.
That which is part of the problem. Like they which feel is, they need to, and they do.
They feel they need to because of the lawsuits, and
right, they do have a need to. That was
The story was during a time when Dan Gooden at Ars Technica and was being sued by Keeper Security. I'll just leave a period point right there, and I won't say anything further about that company for fear of legal reprisals. But that happened, and there was such a large outpouring of support for him for doing his job.
Oh, yeah.
And absolutely. I wanted to dig into this because there is a chilling effect in InfoSec, in security research, because there are so many times and so many places where people will just drop ODAs because they don't have any other way of, look, you know, and this is kind of maybe a bit full circle, but, you know, with my Tourette's, you know, I have a tick, it has to come out, and it's not really that dissimilar from, you know, in a sense, in a weird kind of connection to hackers who do work, and it needs to come out. It needs to be out there.
I understand exactly what you're saying.
And reporters, get a story, and it needs to be out. It needs to get out there, and it needs to be published, and people need to see it. Not for any kind of gratification, but because we serve the public.
Mm-hmm.
And hackers and security researchers serve the public.
And the organizations just don't get that.
And they don't understand that. And so it's not a surprise that security researchers and hackers will drop ODAs anonymously on the internet because they have no other way of getting the information out there without being able to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's horrifying. I've had so many stories of people who have said, you know, off the record, you can't use this, and I respect that, of people who have gone through some absolute dire straits, and I wrote my story in and I included you in there.
Mm-hmm.
And that broke my fucking heart. It was seeing so many people hurt by...
How many responses did you get to that?
I think 16, 17. I included all of them that I was able to report. I got some that were off the record. Some mm-hmm. people just wanted to talk.
Yeah, I had to imagine you got responses from people that were just like, you can't report any of this, but I want to give you my support. Here's my story. Please do what you're doing.
And it's so heartbreaking to think that reporters are being sued and being silenced and having a chilling effect because we're doing our job. We're trying to hold people accountable. Look, I've always said that reporters, our one job is to hold people, companies, and governments accountable for their actions, and everything else is basically advertising. Hackers and security researchers, you're just trying to do your job. You're just trying to get the information out there. You're just trying to fix the world, save the world, secure the world.
Yeah.
And you've got companies out there who would just fight for the name of their own, for the sake of their own name.
Oh, absolutely.
Not even.
Sometimes it's for the sake of just not having to do any work.
Yeah.
I have one I've been dealing with for years now with the organizations involved. And when I had first uncovered the problem, it's with some critical infrastructure. And yeah. I contacted Chris Roberts, you know, PsyDragon, who had experience in a related field. And I said, hey, I'm definitely over my head with how massive this finding I have is. Can you help me you know, proceed. I asked him for some mentorship and said, hey, where should I go from here? And we talked several times on the phone at length, and we were assembling a plan and like, how do we release this? How can we get the companies to understand? Who do we talk to? Do you have contacts here? Do you have contacts there? And one of the first things he said to me was, are you ready for that knock on your door?
Yeah.
Because you're going to get a knock on your door. And he says, you're probably not going to go to jail and you're probably not going to be sued, but you're going to get a knock. Are you willing to have that happen? You know, you're going to be in trouble for a short while at least.
Yeah.
We can get you lawyers. I have, you know, people here. We have the EFF. We can start making calls now. But there's no way to openly discuss this without the knock. And that's ridiculous. And I did end up, I've gone to the companies and I've gone to the associations that are supposed to regulate the companies. And they're tigers with no teeth. These associations that are supposed to regulate don't have any means of retaliation. They can't fine these companies. They just set regulations and go, here's your best practices. Please do this.
And best practices don't mean anything.
Right. And these companies say, right,
they can do whatever they want, you know.
Right. And so when literally at the push of a small amount of buttons can cause food to not arrive in remote parts of the country. And the response is, oh, well, that's going to take a few million dollars to fix. So no. And also, if you say anything, we'll sue you into the ground.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
It's unbelievable.
There are no words. It is unbelievable. Who could believe that that's a situation, a state that can exist?
And to kind of go full circle, this is kind of a reason why researchers and reporters aren't in a sense aren't too dissimilar. We kind of want to do the best of the world. I mean, some researchers, some reporters, sure, but I think for most of us, we want the best for the world. We want the best to come out of it. And the sad reality is that we will have so many people fighting against us, whether it's the feds, or whether it's a company, or whether it's, you know, other people. You know, we're trying to do the best that we can. We're trying to get the work out there. We're trying to get the information out there. We're trying to make the world safer. Trying to make the world more informed. And it's kind of bizarre to think that, you know, researchers and reporters can be so... There can be such animosity between the two. I realize that some reporters cannot, you know, aren't necessarily always by the book. Some reporters aren't ethical. Some reporters, you know, have pressures from upstairs. But I think, you know...
There are even some that just aren't knowledgeable. And they maybe give the short end of the stick. They get and they get the animosity that maybe they don't deserve. But as researchers, we're so frustrated with incorrect information being given to the public.
It's understandable. You know, I will spend so long on a story just to make everything right.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, there will be times where I'll miss something. And it's the smallest thing. And it's so frustrating. But, you know, you jump back in there, you make a correction, you add the correction to the bottom, and
I've seen you do it, and it's great.
And I think reporting is you have to be so transparent about this stuff. You have to be transparent. If you're not transparent, then what's the point?
Right. You can't just go back and edit the article. You have to add the note that
you have
says
to.
Correction.
And this is my point.
Previously, I had said this. This was wrong.
Sorry. Whoops. Yeah, but
you know,
we
respect it. That's fantastic. Yeah. That really does save your ass.
But it goes back to the point that journalism should be open source. It should not be proprietary. It should not be closed off. It should be open and transparent, so you can see what's going on, so you can understand what we do. And I wrote the story, you know, maybe 2 years ago about how I report a data breach. And I work closely with Troy Hunt, who is just a...
Troy's amazing.
Wow. He is a guy. I have this weekly newsletter, which I recently started. I'm almost 3 weeks in. And I gave him a mention in my... in my section, which is good people doing good things, and I basically said that, you know, this shout out goes to Troy Hunt for winning the award for being Troy Hunt. He is a good guy who cares so much, and you know, I can go to him and I can say, look, you know, I've got this breach data. What do I do with it? And with recently with this story about Mega, that file sharing site based in New Zealand, which I wrote about, I think, this week or last week. It's been a long week. I can't even figure out when it was. I gave him the data a couple of weeks ago and asked him to kind of run some stats for me. He gave me the stats and he said it's basically at this point almost certainly not a breach, but a credential stuffing. Great, good to know.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had an ethical dilemma of, because it wasn't just usernames and passwords that were dumped in this file, but the credential stuffing kind of attack that happened with it is that, from what I understand, from speaking to some of the victims of this data exposure, I suppose, was that the file, their accounts were accessed and their file names
mm-hmm.
were scraped.
Mm-hmm.
One account in there contained a large amount of child abuse imagery.
Mm-hmm.
I could see it in the file listings.
Sure.
At that point, that person who had that account was not a source, but they had enough information in there where I was like, I need to make a determination on this and what I do with this. And so I called up a friend of mine who is a very well-known reporter, asked for some ethical advice, and said, I have this information, what do I do with it?
What exactly was your ethical quandary?
My ethical quandary was, do I give this information to the feds?
I was making sure it wasn't, yeah. Do I publicly report this?
Oh, it was very, very, yeah, it was absolutely okay. Very careful. You know, it was essentially, I had two problems. Do I report this information to the feds? And mm-hmm. I went in with a problem and a solution. And my solution was, yes, I think I do.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get that checked with a third party ethical mind.
Mm-hmm.
The third party reporter said, yes, you should report this to the feds. This is the equivalent of witnessing a murder. Mm-hmm. You need to kind of report this. It's kind of your ethical obligation to do so as a human. So I was kind of okay on that. And the other side of this was, how do I report this? And I went in again with a problem and a solution, and I said, I think I need to do this transparently, and I think I need to explain what I did and that I reported this.
Mm-hmm.
And my third party reporter friend said, yeah, that's exactly what you do. I did not compromise the source. I would never compromise a source. I would go to prison before I compromise a source. There have been situations where I've been in a position where I faced that problem before. Even with that breathalyzer story, I would not give up the source of the document that I received.
And here, as we stated before, you're protected from that. You're not
required.
I am to
a degree, but you know what? I can have a judge can pull me in and say, a judge can call me in and say, I want to know your source. Will you reveal that source? And I will say no.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in contempt of court. It's a weird, bizarre loophole to the First Amendment.
Right. And then you have to continue to fight that. You have to fight the contempt charge and
while I'm in prison.
Right.
And while other reporters have gone to prison for that. Mm-hmm. And it's heartbreaking to see.
I mean, you're at this conference was the first place Kevin Mitnick appeared after he was released from prison. And
right.
Famous for spending 10 years without, without a conviction.
So I ended up asking, how to report this story and transparently. And yeah, it was one of those cases where, look, I draw the line. There are times when I will come across, a report where someone has tried default creds, or they have, done a minor criminality in trying to find a vulnerability. And yeah, look, the CFAA, we all know, is vast and overbroad at the best of times.
Mm-hmm.
But I will not necessarily overlook, but it's about balancing. It's about the balancing act of having information and making sure that source is protected for the greater good. If you try some default creds on the router and you end up protecting an airport from a giant hack,
mm-hmm.
that is a good thing, and I will protect you. But if you are a random person hosting child abuse imagery in your file sharing folder, yeah. I draw the line.
Yeah, absolutely.
As you should.
It's
a bizarre.
Nobody
world.
Should ever argue against that.
Exactly.
Point.
And my point was, I'm going to explain this in my story and say, look, we reported this to the feds, and mm-hmm. I knew the feds were going to investigate or do something, and there was no way that I would ever get a nod from them or even off the record, whatever, we've done this because it's an active law enforcement investigation. And I respect that. But I did say, in providing them with this information, I said, look, I would like to report on this story, and I'd like to, kind of be able to report the story without compromising anything.
Right. And at least you would like to mention that among the things you discovered were clear child abuse.
Yeah. And so I did. And so I spent a few weeks on that story just waiting. I mean, it's a difficult position to be in because, ultimately, I absolutely will always protect my sources. But if you're in a data breach and you're doing something like that, you do not get to hide. Not at all.
No, there's nothing to protect.
There's nothing to protect at that point.
And that's, yeah, you're not in violation of your own code. There's nothing to protect there. There's nothing there deserves protection.
Yeah. So that was a wild week.
Yeah. Well, well, Zach, we're a few minutes over here. I think what a great end. The interview actually got rolling and relevant, and that's cool. And honestly, I didn't mean it to.
No, I really appreciate you having me on. And that's what I mean. This is a real opportunity. I'm really excited to kind of be on the show.
I'm excited to have you here. I'm excited. This is your first con. I love that Hope is your first con because it's mine, and so we all have this love of like our first con, you know. Yeah.
Are you going to be at Black Hat and Def Con?
I'll be at Def Con this year. I will not be.
I will be on holiday, taking a much overdue holiday.
I don't recommend you go to Vegas ever. So good.
I burn. So quickly, I will not survive the desert heat.
We don't go outside. Yeah. I don't know if you're familiar with researchers. We don't.
I've heard.
I have my basement transported right next to DEF CON.
Oh, that's how you do it. Yeah, I always figured. I always wondered.
Yeah. All right, Zach. Great having you. Great having you here on Radio Statler. Zach Whitaker of ZDNet, one of my absolute favorite tech journalists, information security journalists, doing great work here.
Thank you, and thank you for having me.
Thank you. Have a great time at the con.
Thank you. And you.